Hey guys, it's Lebo here to tell you about your new favorite go-to underwear, undershirt, and sock brand, Mr. Davis. It's a local KC company with the most comfortable undergarments you'll ever wear. I'll never wear another brand again. Go to MrDavis.com/810 for your new favorite undergarments.
The Zone is presented by Guaranteed Foods, delivering all-natural food to Midwestern families since 1958. Enjoy healthier food, more free time, free delivery, and better value. Go to GuaranteedFoods.com.
All right, we continue right here on Sports Radio 810 WHB. Jason Anderson with you, Sterling Holmes, Dylan Michaels. Thank you to Jack Johnson hanging out with us the previous 2 hours. We will talk with Mick Schaefer coming up at 1 o'clock, 913-912-4810. We talked a lot of NFL draft, a lot of Chiefs in the first couple of hours, as expected, with the draft wrapping up on Saturday, hearing from Xavier Worthy and Kingsley Suamataia and Mike Borgonzi. We'll hear from Clark Hunt as well. We'll get into a couple of other things with the NFL draft. But right now, let's talk some Royals baseball. Josh Kiser, One Royal Way podcast, joins us here in the Zone. And Josh, while the draft was going on, the Royals went ahead and played some baseball games too. How about that, huh? They decided to continue their season.
Yeah, sure did. It was pretty brave of them to step into the limelight like that. It's fun to see that they're not scared of challenges.
That's right. Let's take on the NFL draft and let's play some games. Unfortunately, they did play those games over the weekend. Would have liked them to not play the games on Saturday and Sunday. But let's just start with this because, look, there's some things we can talk about from Saturday's game, certainly, from yesterday's game as well. But this is a team 1 month in. I had mentioned it as we went to break. They're 17-12 right now, 29 games in. There's 11 more games before you get to the 40-game mark. There's 10 more games we've talked about this stretch of baseball where they play some really good teams. Your assessment of this team from what you thought it was going to be and now a month in April, the pitching, the lineup, the defense, et cetera, where's it at, and what is sustainable, do you think, moving forward, and what is more maybe playing above their head or below their head?
I think personally that the pitching is pretty sustainable as far as the starting rotation goes. I think they've proven that a corner has been turned, that it's a unit that can be depended on to keep them in games, which is huge. I've always said coming on the show that the rotation is always going to be ultimately where the floor is with this team. Is that is what was missing the last few years, is a consistent rotation that can stop the bleeding, that can keep you in ball games, and won't allow pressure or added pressure to go towards the bullpen and the lineup. The two or three arms during the bullpen that are pretty reliable, quote-unquote, relatively reliable. I think James MacArthur is an absolute monster. He's doing really, really well and doing everything that he promised he would do last season. But other than, bullpens are volatile as they go. So if right now John Schreiber's throwing well, James MacArthur's throwing well, Chris Stratton was doing okay until Saturday, and then the wheels kind of fell off there. Mm-hmm. But I don't know how much I'm relying on the bullpen sustaining what they've done in the last few weeks. But you never know. Hopefully that's not the case. But the lineup is ultimately where the inconsistency is showing, and that is what's really going to keep this team from really getting to where they need to be.
So what part of it do you think can improve, and what part of it is just – and I'm talking about the lineup now, because that's where I do want to make the transition, talk about that, because there are some struggles going on. I mean, MJ Melendez – started the season, shot out of a cannon, and now he's like one for his last 25. And Hunter Renfroe has sort of just been this guy throughout the year. He's ran into a couple of home runs, but he's like one for his last 25. Nelson Velasquez is like one for his last 20. So you've got some guys that are going through slumps together, and you've got the top four. Now that Michael Garcia has broken out of his slump and is back to playing baseball and swinging the bat the way that we all figured he would be swinging the bat. So you've got Garcia, and you've got Bobby Witt, you've got Vinny, who's now fallen into a little bit of a slump over his last 20-25 at bats or so, and you've got Salvi, those four guys. And outside of that, we're seeing so much inconsistency, and I think the number is the last 29 runs batted in have been, 26 of those have been from the top four guys in the lineup. And then if you look at the three that were not driven in by those top four guys, two of them were hit by pitches. So you've got one RBI in your last essentially 30 that was actually driven in or ball put in play by somebody not in the top four of the lineup. And yet they found ways to win, and I think that's a credit to what you're talking about, the pitching staff, which will allow them to sort of get through some of these slumps. But I do wonder, is this a slump or is this just simply how the Royals will win games moving forward, that they'll find a way to win four in a row, one-run games, and then they'll have an inning or two where they run into a team that puts up a crooked number and the offense isn't necessarily good enough to get back over that hump.
Yeah, 100%. That's my biggest worry about, you know, like the ceiling of where they can get to this year. The thing about the RBIs is that those RBIs are probably coming a lot from the bottom of the order guys getting on, which is a rarity. So the fact that they are getting them in is very surprising. But like you said, Michael Garcia is just now kind of starting to step up, and then now you might have four guys that pitchers might be scared to throw to. Then you have five holes between the five spot and the nine spot that at any given moment are 1-for-22 or 0-for-19 or whatever it is.
Yeah.
That's going to limit every offense of all time. You can't really do that. And a lot of that's coming from the guys that you paid to come in and do that. The Hunter Renfroe, the Adam Frazier, the Garrett Hampson. All three of those guys are absolutely suboptimal in the lineup whenever they get some run. And it's tough to see, especially when you see a guy like Nick Lofton having some success and then getting sent down. So a guy like Drew Waters, who's doing well in Omaha, even if he is the same as he has been over the last few years, that's still better than what you're getting from Hunter Renfroe, from what you're getting from Garrett Hampson, from what you're getting from Adam Frazier. So I think at some point, especially after that 40-game mark, I think you start to see some of those churning happening. But also I think the fact that those guys are starting to get a little bit matchup. They're not matchup proof anymore. They're not the established veterans that are getting the benefit of the doubt to get out of that slump. You're starting to see them get pinch hit way more. And I think that's pretty telling to where we'll be in a month or so.
So what does it say to you then that, you know, and maybe this is a credit, as you talked about, to the starting staff, but if we go back to the time frame of the slumps that these different players are having, given it, you know, MJ Melendez and Hunter Renfroe and Nelson Velazquez and Vinny Pascantino, that we're looking at like four or five game stretches to where these guys have had this sort of rut that they've been in, and the Royals are still 3-2 in those five games. I mean, that's probably three games better than what they would be expected to be in years past. I mean, so what's the ceiling? We know what the ceiling certainly could be if the offense turns it around, but I think what we've seen is that the floor is so much higher than what it's been in the past that maybe they won't get to their ceiling, but the bottom isn't necessarily falling out, even when they have, you know, was it a three-game losing streak? And then they go and win four in a row, and they've lost a couple of games there in Detroit. Even when they have a rut or a struggle that's there, that the floor is somehow you've got four or five guys in your lineup that are, you know, one for their last 30 and combined like four hits in their last like 90 at bats, and you still went 3-2 in that stretch and had a chance to go, you know, 4-1 if it wasn't for a blow up inning with Stratton.
Yeah, 100%. That rotation keeps you in those games where even if the offense is slumping, baseball karma, that when you're losing games 8-3 does not matter. Suddenly the baseball karmatic experiences that we see really start to add up and lead to wins instead of just meaningless runs in garbage time. So being able to stress the emphasis or emphasize the impact that those starting pitchers have had on this team, it starts in the win column right there. So being able to be in games enough for the offense to wake up, the slumps to start, the baseball karma kind of coming back to your side, the defense picking you up and allowing, you know, great plays to be able to establish some momentum so the lineup is a little bit, you know, rolling when they get their chance to you know, make an impact. It all kind of starts with that pitching rotation, and I think that is where this team's going to go, is so goes the rotation.
Visiting with Josh Kiser, One Royal Way podcast. All right, we talk about the lineup and how it looks offensively. What's sort of that level of weight scale in what they're not doing offensively but Matt Quatrero sticking with a number of guys because of what they are doing defensively, which is a, you know, big part of helping that starting staff out, of helping the bullpen out, is that how well they are playing defense, the plays they are making. I mean, Adam Frazier in right field getting a double play off of what should have been a two-run home run on Friday. You've got Bobby Witt that continues to make Willie Mays catches into, you know, shallow outfield where he's just looking like a wide receiver, tracking the ball better than Mecole Hardman, which is not necessarily that tough to do, but he is able to do that even on a baseball diamond. But they are number one in Major League Baseball in defensive runs saved. So that weight scale of sort of weighing, okay, this is what they aren't doing offensively, but what they're doing in the field is a pretty decent part of why that starting staff is able to keep them in games because the offense is struggling.
And really, that's where you can start to really pinpoint the areas that you can address and make an impact on both sides. A guy like Garrett Hampson, I don't understand what would you say you do here type of thing. I've kind of said that since spring training, and it's kind of coming true. But he's not out there enough to make a huge impact, I don't think. But, like, Kyle Isbell is making great plays in center field, as does Kyle Isbell does. But he's also really struggling at the plate. Hunter Renfroe is doing both things poorly. He's not fielding the well. He's got a couple outfield assists, but he's not doing what you want him to do at the plate. So I think that's an easy decision if he doesn't, you know, step it back up. Michael Garcia is playing great defense at third base, even when he is slumping. It's fine over there at third base. MJ Melendez, pretty decent in left field so far this year, and we've seen him be able to get into balls, especially there at the beginning of the year. Same with Nelly Velasquez. He is absolutely slumping. If you're not playing him in the field, he's on the chopping block, and he's on the hot seat, I think, for sure. So there are guys on there where opportunity does come to improve either way, either defensively or offensively. There are in-house options to do it at where they're, you know, where they're currently lying. But there are other guys like the Isbells, like the Adam Fraziers, that MJ Melendez, that you just got to ride it out, and they're going to do what they're going to do and impact where they can impact. But we'll see some of those transactions kind of roll over whenever it's time, I think.
Visiting with Josh Kaiser, One Royal Way podcast. Let's talk about some of the decisions that take place in game. I credited Matt Quatrero last week when he went to MacArthur for a two-inning save, which was fantastic. I love the decisions that were made there and the strategy behind the whole thing. Is it hindsight to look at Saturday and say, you know, Zerpa came out there and it took nine pitches to get three outs? One of those was a loud out, you know, hit pretty hard up the middle, but, you know, it's still was an out and nine pitches to then go to Chris Stratton and take Angel Zerpa out. Is it hindsight looking at that, or was it foresight and at the time of, man, I would have left Angel Zerpa in there even though it was going to be nine and then the top of the order, and Stratton's a guy that you've relied on in that situation, and you got Schreiber and MacArthur, and sort of setting it up from that standpoint. Would you have liked to see him stay with Angel Zerpa one more inning, or you were fine with that move? Angel Zerpa did his job. Chris Stratton needed to do his.
I think it's more of the latter there. I think that Zerpa did his job. He came in and faced, was it three righties? Verlin Kennedy and Javi Baez, who, that contract is hilarious, by the way. It is very, very funny that they offloaded the Miggy Cabrera contract, and now they still have Javi Baez on the books to be even worse than Miguel Cabrera. But that is beside the point. So he came in, got three quick outs against righties. Historically speaking, he's been really bad against righties. So it is a big deal that he came in and got those outs, even though a couple of them were pretty loud. And then coming up to the order, you said nine and then top of the order. That's still a left-right switch between those top four. And if I'm Matt Quatrero, I'm like, okay, well, we got away with four, or got away with three righties that got out of the inning. That's fine. Maybe he's a hot hand, but Chris Stratton has been pretty solid for us lately. He's gone multiple outings lately that haven't given up an earned run. He's been pretty solid. So we're going to go ahead and roll with him. Schreiber had pitched three out of the previous 4 days. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if he was available at that time. He's been very, very good. He's been really good in the fireman role as well. And even in the beginning of that run, he was warming up. I think it was a Thursday night game or Wednesday when they were – it was close, and he was warming up, and it came in, and the Orioles scored a bunch of runs, and they brought in, I think, Will Smith for mop-up duty at that point. So he had even warmed up at that point prior to that. So I don't even know if he was available to pitch it Saturday. But my point is, like, you didn't want Zerpa seeing more right-handed hitters that she has historically been bad at. Chris Stratton has been good in the recent history, and you should be able to feel comfortable with him doing his job at that point. It just didn't happen.
Yeah, and it's unfortunate. And then the offense, of course, you know, makes a comeback and, you know, has somebody there on the base pads, and you got Vinny up there. You're down 6-5. You were down 6-3, and you make this rally there in the ninth inning. But it's just not enough. And the nail in the coffin, what it felt like, was the Vierling home run. You know, and that was like,
yep.
If Spencer Torkelson would have walked or got a hit, I think he goes to the bullpen. I think he brings in, who was it that was up and throwing? It was a little bit late, but he got up when Carpenter was up, and then as he was getting ready to pitch to Spencer Torkelson, there was somebody up in the bullpen. Maybe it was Sauer. I don't know, because I know he came in and pitched the eighth. But somebody was up there trying to get ready in a hurry. And I think if he would not have retired Spencer Torkelson, it might have been one of those, hey, Salvi, go out and talk to him. Okay, Salvi's done talking to him. Okay, now I'm going to come out of the dugout and make the move. But he got Torkelson to pop out. Now you got two outs, and you're one pitch away from getting out of that inning with minimal damage, 3-3, and an opportunity for your offense to go out there. And hey, Chris Stratton didn't have his best stuff. But, you know, one pitch, and it's 6-3. And you're like, well, it's a five spot, and now you got a couple of at-bats to try to get that thing back and try to score three runs. That one hurt. I think – We can make the argument, like, you know, he kept him in one batter too long, and I do think, yeah, hindsight, he definitely did. And at the time, I'm like, man, Kerry Carpenter single, I'd get him out. Well, you didn't have somebody warming up and ready because it was only a few batters that he was facing, and then he got the out. And I'm like, okay, is he going to get away with this? And he definitely didn't.
And let's give credit where it's due. There, Vierling hit a tough pitch out. I mean, it was a sinker in on his knees. He pulled it in and hit it 111 miles an hour out. I mean,
I think it was, what, 7 feet off the ground? 7 feet off the ground, I think.
I mean, it was a 1-2 count. So, I mean, he takes a good pitch yard in a pitcher-friendly count. It's not necessarily on Stratton. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is a bad pitch, and it wasn't what you wanted on a 1-2, and the outcome certainly proves that, but the fact that he did put it out is more credit to Vierling than I think it is more about Stratton at that point, in my opinion. But, you know, it is what it is. I mean, that's even in that game, the offense still came back and responded to that. And I really think that is one of the most encouraging things that I've seen thus far in the year, is wherever the need is there, especially late in the game, they do have a tendency to respond. Whereas last year, when they would get a lead or tie a game or anything like that, it seemed like immediately the next half inning they would lose that, whether it be the starter being in too long, the bullpen giving it up, an error happening. It seemed like the response was way different than it's been this year. And that has been, to me, the most, outside of the rotation being as solid as it is and potentially exceeding all expectations on that front, the next best thing, as far as the most encouraging thing, is this response from this team has mostly been good.
Yeah, and yesterday, it's like, you know, that's baseball. Skubal's on the mound, and he's going to be tough to hit. He's been their, you know, ace, and when he's on the mound and he's throwing up, you know, zeros outside of that first inning when they, you know, got the run, you know, there's small little cuts that end up, you know, looking bigger because offense is just stymied at that point. So you hang one to a rookie that hits a home run in the first inning, and then you add a sacrifice fly in the second. You give up a solo shot in the sixth, which, by the way, I know defensive run saved and everything. Does that count as a full defensive run save for Freddie Fermin? Because he picks the guy off at first, and then the next pitch is a home run. That's literally a 100%. Run saved.
Yeah. And I talk to my brother all the time about this, but when there's a game-saving, like Frazier, he deserves – one win above replacement for that play he made where he robbed a home run and it turned into a double play.
He gets one more.
That's potentially worth a win. Yeah. Let's talk about that. It's a conversation we need to have.
Yeah, and Freddie Fermin gets a defensive run saved when he picks the guy off at first and the next pitch is a home run. I mean, that's literally 100%. A run saved. All right, last one for you. Jonathan Bolin tonight, filling in for Alec Marsh. We'll see if it's only one start. And they said Marsh on the IL was more precautionary of, look, it's with his elbow and a contusion. No need to, you know, it's early in the season. Let's put him on the 15-day IL. But Bolin getting the start. What do you think of Jonathan Bolin, and what are you excited to see tonight?
I've always been pretty enthralled with Jonathan Bolin. I think he's got good stuff, and his velo back when he was in prospect status and really being considered like, you know, one of the next guys, it was up in the upper 90s, and that was, you know, probably evident to the eventual TJ that he ended up having, and now he's more in like the mid to lower 90s is where it usually lives with that fastball. But so far this year, he's been pretty solid down in Omaha. He's had three or four starts that he's looked pretty good in. Probably the most encouraging thing is that he is living in the zone, throwing the ball and getting beat up too much for it. So I'm pretty excited about that. There are some weird things going on with his slider. I don't quite know. That's what I'm most excited to see with his start tonight, is seeing what's going on with that slider, because he is throwing it way more and it is, you know, doing pretty well. So with his four seam and the slider kind of being the primary pitches that he's going to run with, and keeping them both in the zone, and keeping when he does go out, people are chasing it down in Omaha. So not a lot of whiffs in general, but he is using what he has pretty well. So I'm excited to see what he's able to do against the Toronto lineup that's probably never even seen him. So I'm excited to see what he's got there and how they utilize it. But usually a five pitch mix that he likes to throw in there and keep hitters honest. So big fan of John Bolin, and hopefully he keeps this momentum for the starting rotation going.
Josh Kaiser, One Royal Way podcast. Josh, appreciate the time. Unfortunately, the Royals decided to play while the draft was going on. That was dumb. Maybe next time they'll take a couple of days off while the draft, especially in that town. They were distracted. It makes sense. They won on Friday before the draft started, and then they lose the next couple of games. I really blame the NFL for that one. We'll see what they do in Toronto with their series on the road starting tonight. Josh, you're the man. Appreciate the time as always, brother. Enjoy the baseball. We'll talk next week.
Will do. Looking forward to it, boys. Thanks.
Absolutely. There's Josh Kaiser, One Royal Way podcast. Great stuff from him. Jonathan Bolin on the mound tonight, filling in for Alec Marsh, going up against Rodriguez for the Toronto Blue Jays. Sub-4 ERA for Rodriguez. Just after 6 o'clock is when the game starts tonight for the Royals. We'll take a timeout, come back. More Zone next. All right, we continue right here on Sports Radio 810 WHB. Jason Anderson with you, Sterling Holmes and Dylan Michaels. Heading up till 2 o'clock. We'll talk with Mick Schaefer coming up at 1 o'clock. KSHB 41 Sports Director. Thank you to Josh Kaiser. Royals in action tonight. Game 1 of the set against the Toronto Blue Jays. 0-4 on the season in rubber matches. That might just be a baseball thing early on. Or this team lacks a killer instinct. This team clearly cannot go and win a series. Good luck in the playoffs. I hope
just
you sweep
them. Yeah, just sweep them.
That's right. It's like UConn. Good luck in close games. We won't play one. Okay, well, that's one strategy, I guess.
Touche.
Okay, sure. We're not going to play any close games. Yeah, see how that works out. I doubt that's going to be the case there, buddy. You did not play close games. Oh, whatever. 913-912-4810. Okay, so one of the things we wanted to do is looking at the Chiefs draft class, and, you know, there's always players that maybe we have a crush on, or maybe we want to see the Chiefs select, or we think there's better value elsewhere. Everybody's got their own opinion. And so we've done this in the past where you can look back and go, man, how did the Chiefs pass on Fred Warner and take Breland Speaks? But really, at that point, it's like, how did the Chiefs pass on anybody else in the draft that was available and take Breland Speaks? How did the Chiefs draft on anybody in America that had not played in the NFL yet? How did they pass on Sterling Holmes and take Breland Speaks? So we can look back and say that. At the time, it's like, you know what? This guy is never on the ground. We've heard them talk about it. He's never on the ground. I mean, that's the one good thing about Breland Speaks is that this guy's got cat-like balance. The big one being Mecole Hardman and DK Metcalf. Clyde Edwards-Helaire, we've talked about that, you know. And I think that was more at the time when it was like, really? They could have had T. Higgins? I mean, you took Clyde Edwards-Helaire? Okay. I would have taken Jonathan Taylor if I took a running back. I don't want a running back. I'd rather them take T. Higgins. I'd rather them take Jalen Johnson. I'd rather them take somebody else that was available as a cornerback or a wide receiver, one of those things, but they took a Clyde Edwards-Helaire. Okay, we'll see what happens. Do we feel that way about any of these draft picks in this draft for the Chiefs? So, first round, I say no. I look at some of the wide receivers, and A.D. Mitchell, maybe, is a guy that, you know, might have looked at and said, all right, you know, would you rather have him over Xavier Worthy? Well, I mean, the fact that A.D. Mitchell ends up being pick number 52 tells you that the Chiefs weren't the only team that sort of passed on A.D. Mitchell. He was also the first pick of the next wave of wide receivers. Or really, it wasn't really a wave because he was there sort of by himself. Because there was the Worthy and then Pearsall, Leggett, Coleman, McConkey, Polk. And four of those in a row. And then a space. And then Polk. And then like 15 or 20 picks before it got to A.D. Mitchell. And then not until the third round at that point. So I don't look at it and go, you know what, I'd rather have one of these wide receivers over Xavier Worthy. Offensive lineman? Well, I don't know. Maybe the conversation was Kingsley Suamataia. But I was good with the pick on Xavier Worthy. I like the pick of Xavier Worthy. We talked about it before. I didn't think he was just a speed merchant. I think he's a wide receiver that's also really fast and not a really fast guy that happens to play wide receiver. That there's a big difference with that. So I'm fine with Xavier Worthy. I'm not looking back and saying, excuse me, looking back and saying, I wish they would have drafted this guy at this particular pick. You good with Worthy?
So this was really hard for me because the way we broke down this hypothetical, and this is kind of a point to make to all the folks that think that Brett Veach is a bad drafter. And also the ones that think that he can do no wrong. So this is kind of a fun little exercise we could do. The key is you have to stay where you're at. So that means you have to draft at 28 because there's too many hypotheticals of trading back and all this stuff. That's just going to be too difficult. No forced trades. Not doing that. I did two different sets here, Jason. I did one where I stayed with Worthy.
Okay.
And I did one where I drafted Cooper DeJean.
Interesting. Okay.
And the reason why I have two different sets is because of how the board fell. I love Kingsley. You know, I think that's the best value possible at that point. But you also know if I'm high on Wanye Morris, could I do something different? So in one of my hypotheticals, I the first two rounds, I left it as is. I went with Worthy and I went with Kingsley. And the second one, I went with Cooper DeJean and Malachi Corley.
First pick of the third round.
First pick in the third round.
From WKU, Western Kentucky. Toppers.
Debo Samuel Light, baby.
Hill Toppers in the house.
5'11", 215.
Yeah, you know I like Malachi.
So I think that's the way I broke it down was, and I'm flip-flopping right now on which one I want to go with for my, you know, deal or no deal. When you have to, you have to knock it down. But that's right. How my first two rounds right now are breaking down.
Dylan, you good with Xavier Worthy?
The only thing I did want to point out is that the Ricky Pearsall and Xavier Leggett picks after that will now kind of provide potential DK Metcalfs and those likes, but
well,
I do like it.
There was four in a row.
Right.
Because it was Pearsall, Leggett, and then the first two picks of the second round.
Talk about like a fifth-year option. Like,
I see what you're
looking
saying.
For that.
Yes, I see
you're
what you're
right.
Saying. Yeah,
but
yeah,
like
yeah.
If you want the 5 years of a wide receiver, it's going to be interesting to see what a guy in San Francisco does that they just seem to have people open on every play. And then, you know, Bryce Young, obviously a little different, but the Panthers seem to value Leggett enough to go up, get a fifth-year option on a receiver that's a big weapon for your rookie that had a pretty bad first year.
Yeah, moving up one spot to go and get him and not waiting until Friday
we
night.
We probably would have had to trade with Ravens if we wanted Pearsall. I don't think the Niners were going to flip picks with us, especially after the Super Bowl. Mm-hmm. Maybe they would. But
well, they did in the second round, but maybe not in the first round if they loved Pearsall. But.
Yeah.
See, I would look at all four of those and even throw in Jalen Polk of those five because 31, 32, 33, 34, and then 37 were all wide receivers right after Xavier Worthy.
Sure.
So there's a really good cluster of comparison there. And if you want to throw in A.D. Mitchell at 52, you're talking about the first, because there wasn't another wide receiver taken in the second round after A.D. Mitchell. It wasn't until Malachi Corley, the first pick of the third round. So that group of receiver number 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10, all sort of together, jumbled together, is Xavier Worthy the best of the bunch? Is he a good player? Does Keon Coleman turn out to be amazing? Ladd McConkey with the Chargers, and I'm a little annoyed as to what the Chargers did for Justin Herbert and getting Brendan Rice later in the draft, which we may talk about here in a little bit. And A.D. Mitchell is now added to a Colts team that if Anthony Richardson is healthy, I mean, they've got some playmakers. They've got some weapons there in Indianapolis, and they also got, you know, one of the best defensive players in the entire draft at pick number 15, where Chris Ballard, you know, they had the video there in the draft room of him with his sort of evil laugh of they let us get the best bleeping pass rusher in the draft. They let us get the best bleeping pass rusher in the draft. and they come back and then they get A.D. Mitchell. It's like, wow, that's pretty good. Chris Ballard, nice job. He didn't have to move up to, unless they did trade up and get A.D. Mitchell. Did they trade back? That was a traded pick. I just can't remember if they traded up or whatever.
So but it says here it went from Rams to Panthers to Colts, that A.D. Mitchell pick.
Yeah, so maybe they did end up trading up for that. Regardless, they still got that pick as well. I'm good with Xavier Worthy. I'm going to stay with that pick. Kingsley Suamataia, I'm staying with that pick as well.
Got
like my first two, I'm totally good with both of those. Now, you've got a scenario where you went defensive back.
Yes, which changes the entire draft complex.
Yeah, I was going to say, so the entire draft gets changed in that scenario. I didn't come up with 15 different hypotheticals.
I have two, Jason.
Well, you kind of have more, because then with Cooper DeJean in the first round, now you get a different second, a different third, a different fourth.
No, because 4 through 7 is going to be the same no matter what.
Oh, okay, interesting. All right.
Second 4 through 7.
See, that's where mine starts to change. Okay.
So my if I go with Worthy and Kingsley, then my first fourth rounder is Chris Abrams-Drain, cornerback from Mizzou. If I went Cooper DeJean in the first round, then my second rounder is Malachi Corley, and my fourth rounder, first one, is Austin Booker, defensive end from Kansas. I didn't mean to keep it locally, but I thought those picks, value-wise, mm-hmm. fit very well. I like Chris Abrams-Drain a lot. I like the physicality he brings. I thought he'd be great in Spag's system. I think Dave Merritt would have a lot of fun with him. Then on the flip side, if I went with Cooper in the first round, well, then I went wide receiver second and edge rusher third. So that I thought Austin Booker was going to be gone well before then. I think that's a very good pick. I love his upside. I know it's another edge rusher, but this is the type of edge rusher with upside that I think the Chiefs would love to have on their team.
Staying with Kingsley?
Yeah, I'm staying with Kingsley.
Yep. Third round, I'm staying with the person that they picked, which is nobody. In the fourth round for the because we're not doing the trade scenario. I'm trading back up to get this guy. No, we're not. We're not.
We can't
doing that.
Do it because, again, it's forced trades. You can't do forced trades.
Not doing it. So we move on to then the fourth round, where the Chiefs get two picks in Jared Wiley and they get Jaden Hicks. And I like both of these selections for the Chiefs. I'm not changing out either of these. So these first four picks in the draft, you know, looking at the different players and things like that, I'm pretty good with. I'm pretty good with the only one I may change is Jared Wiley, but I understand why they went that route. I mean, Noah Gray's coming up on the last year of his contract, and then you got, you know, Irv Smith, and, you know, we saw what happened when somebody went down and you were dealing with Blake Bell, you know, running routes out there. I think it's fine to try to find and start to find somebody that may be the next guy to take over for Travis Kelce. Maybe he's that guy, maybe he's not, but he gets to learn under Travis Kelce. And I know Noah Gray did as well. So it's not like, well, you learn under Travis Kelce, you turn out to be an all-pro. I think Noah Gray could have had a lot more yards and numbers last year, especially the first game. I just don't think Patrick Mahomes looked his way the way that he would have if 87 was out there. Because there were a lot of plays where there were a few plays where Noah Gray was just running wide open and was like, hi, hello, and Mahomes just went in a different direction, went to somebody else. And that's not happening if it's 87, because he's looking at him. And maybe he's not running free if it's 87. But he was running free. So Noah Gray, it's like, well, he ended up with like 3 catches. Yeah, he could have 6 for like 115 if Kelce wasn't there. And it might have been a different conversation. Regardless, it's nice to have an extra guy in there when you know you're playing that 12 personnel. You want to play multiple tight ends there throughout the game.
I'm leaving Jaden Hicks for sure. I don't think that's even a question. I think I think that that value 100%. Was phenomenal. And again, if I stay with Worthy and Kingsley, then I'm going Chris Abrams-Drain as my pick 131. If I went with the other scenario, I'm going with Austin Booker.
Okay. All right. Dylan, you go with Hicks and Wiley?
Yeah, I think I am. Yep. Especially with all the people that went right before Wiley, like TJ Tampa, Isaac Guarendo, Will Shipley. Those guys were... seem like we wanted as well, and it was a, okay, well, now let's just take our guy.
But, yeah. I was...
Jaden Hicks is just...
I was hoping they were going to get TJ Tampa.
Mm. I bet Brent Veach was as well.
Yeah, probably was. I bet Dave Merritt and... But Steve Spagnuolo, both of those guys were as well, because it would have been a fourth round cornerback.
Yeah.
They did get a defensive back in the fourth round and safety Jaden Hicks, which is a requirement for them to grab somebody that plays in the secondary.
Boy, the Ravens getting TJ Tampa and Nate Wiggins.
Yeah.
And that draft's pretty good.
Yeah, not bad. Yeah.
Do you know who the compensatory pick was from for Jaden Hicks?
Wasn't that from...
Wiley?
Was that the Buffalo one?
Yes, it was.
Yeah.
So Buffalo helped us out twice.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. From Jaden Hicks. Let's move on. This is where I start to move some things around. And it's a late round. It's not like, you know, these guys may make a difference or not. I understand the Hunter Norzad pick, and I know you love it. A guy that can come in and play in the interior offensive line, can play center, can play guard. He did play some tackle. So they need somebody to help out without having Allegretti. And he can be competition for Caliendo. And also they need to find somebody that can maybe snap the football if Creed Humphrey can't. I mean, if Creed Humphrey is struggling to snap the football, I mean, you know, it would have been, if you still had Allegretti, then I think that's an easy, like, okay, move Allegretti there, move Creed Humphrey to guard or whatever, if Joe Tooney's gone, whatever. But he needs to fix that. And it was like, well, he's had some injuries and okay. I thought they would address the cornerback position in this draft. I thought they would have addressed the running back position. I thought maybe they would throw more numbers at wide receiver. Now, you're limited in the number of picks you have, and that's part of, you know, moving up and all of that stuff. They didn't lose a draft pick in terms of trading things. They just moved around the draft board. I couldn't believe that in the fifth round, Kalen Carson from Wake Forest, the cornerback, was still there. A guy that some people thought was a second or third rounder, and he's in the fifth round. So I wanted TJ Tampa, and that's a physical guy in Kalen Carson, has some of those traits, long arms, you know, that you would look at and say, well, the Chiefs would like that guy. And so if I'm sitting there in the fifth round as opposed to taking an interior offensive line in the fifth round, somebody that may just sort of be a role player, and I don't know, can you find somebody else to fill that spot? Having depth helps. Certainly, because if somebody gets injured, you're going to go, well, thank God you had Hunter Norzad, if he's out there playing, right? If he's good. He's a fifth rounder, you know, and I know Trey Smith was a sixth rounder, but that was medical. He was a second round talent that went in the sixth round because of a heart issue. It's typically not something you deal with, or blood clots in the lungs is what it was. Either way, you've got some issues that are there with Trey Smith, and the medicals is why he was there in the sixth round. I would have gone cornerback there with that pick in the fifth round and address that. So I'd had a cornerback in Kalen Carson that I did not think was should have been available at that time. That would have been the spot that I went with. So I'd have changed that up, Hunter Norzad.
Either way, in my scenarios, I had a cornerback earlier. So I think we're the same page where we valued cornerback position fairly highly. I left the fifth round the exact same. I like Norzad. Mm-hmm. I like the versatility. I think he's going to be great as far as plug and play, Allegretti, Wiley, however you want to view him, more of an Allegretti, I think.
Yeah.
But again, I think it's very important to have on a roster. I know it's not a fun pick. I know you could always go another wide receiver, another guy you can actually see numbers for.
Yeah.
But I think for roster construction, I was a huge fan of this pick, and so I'm actually leaving this one the exact same.
Dylan?
Yeah, same.
Okay.
Same. I just think the you could probably put him at all across the interior of the offensive line.
Yeah.
Is there somebody else they could have found later on? Who knows? But
sure.
I just, looking at him, like, I think they're going to address the cornerback position, and the fact that Carson was still there and, like, he shouldn't be there, I would have gone that route. Sixth round, Kamal Hayden, I know you like this pick. Mm-hmm. I went Kalen Carson in the fifth round. So now that, you know, I've addressed the cornerback spot, so now I'm here. Do I take in, I don't know. I don't know that Hunter Norzad would be there, you know, as an offensive lineman. Probably not. They didn't think he would be there as well. But at this spot in the sixth round, because I got a cornerback in the fifth round, I would have loved to see them take Brendan Rice from USC to throw some numbers at the wide receiver spot. And the fact that he ended up with the Chargers is a little annoying. I could not believe that Brendan Rice was there in the seventh round. You wouldn't have got him with your seventh round picks. You would have had to spend your sixth round pick on him. So I changed the interior offensive line and cornerback position to cornerback and wide receiver, and I would have liked to see them go and get Brendan Rice from USC.
I was the same. I said Brendan Rice. I had a chance to actually interview him.
Oh, that's why. You know, name dropper.
Well, no, but I'm saying when I left that, I was left with a really good understanding, because you never know how former sons of former great athletes,
mm-hmm.
how they are.
Yeah.
And it was clear he was trying to not separate himself, but understand that he's his own man. He's not going to rest on his dad's laurels and be like, oh, I'm Jerry's son.
Yeah.
That's not what he was about at all. I will say the one concerning thing, and Dylan was there. He gave me a good question to ask. He never ran the hill. I asked, I go, hey, did you ever run the hill? He goes, no, I never ran the hill. So
you know what that is, Jason?
I don't.
Work ethic?
So is that Jerry Rice?
Correct. That's his training in the offseason, and yeah. A lot of like current NFL players at the time would try and do it. Like Barry Sanders, I don't know if it was Barry, but I'm just like, you know, yeah. naming high-level people would go out, and they couldn't do it. And it was a constant uphill run. So
literally.
Yeah, for real.
Literally, constantly working uphill to get there. I think now that you mentioned like Jerry Rice and literally running the hill, I think I remember hearing that and seeing some stories on that. But if his son didn't do it, then that now I question his work ethic. I now change everything about my draft.
I just thought he was very professional, too. Just everything about him. It gave off that aura of this is a guy who's going to come in and he's going to work and find a way to get it done. And I think he has the skills as well. So I like Brandon Rice as well in the sixth.
Dylan, you good with
I agree.
Yeah. And then last one in the seventh round, they took C.J. Hansen. And I get it. Again, they're throwing numbers at the interior offensive line. And I just want to restate, I'm totally fine with this draft. I like the players that they came away with. What we're doing is an exercise to where, you know, the summer when it was heading into training camp in 2019, how many people were saying the Chiefs made a huge mistake by not drafting DK Metcalf, by drafting Mecole Hardman? They should have taken DK Metcalf. And there are probably some people that were like, you know, because I remember at the time, it's like, dude, DK Metcalf was there, and that guy is an athletic freak. And there were plenty of people that thought, you know, this guy's going to be really good. So some went on record with it. Some of it's hindsight being 2020. So we're just simply doing this exercise. If there were players out there you would have liked to see. And in the seventh round, C.J. Hansen. Now, I know with this draft, I don't end up with any interior offensive lineman help. I draft Kingsley Suamataia, and I don't end up with another one. But I would have loved to see Blake Watson for the Chiefs, Memphis running back. He ends up signing with Denver, the Broncos, which sucks. But Blake Watson, to me, was that spark plug, that change of pace, the quick through the hole, quick burst, lightning fast, can get on the outside in an outside zone and turn it up and be gone. I just think that is missing from this running back room. And again, maybe Imani Bailey, whose athletic testing was terrible, doesn't necessarily match the film. So I'm cautiously optimistic that he could be that guy. But they need somebody in this running back room that has some juice to his legs, that has some quickness, some burst, some sudden burst. Not that they're running too fast and running into the back end offensive lineman. You need to have some patience there. But when the hole opens up, he gets there in time before it closes. I would have liked to see, you know, Blake Watson to add that speed to the running back room. But again, if you don't have the offensive line depth, then that speed in the running back room may not help if you're, you know, not blocking very well.
Yeah, I actually love Blake Watson. That was really hard. He was in my final three of guys to put. And again, we're talking about seventh round here at this point. But yeah, Blake Watson was a guy that was very intriguing. A younger, almost Jerick McKinnon.
Yeah.
That third down back. And the one where I left Worthy and Kingsley, I went with Cody Schrader. The production means so much. And he fits what the Chiefs do. They don't draft these speedster running backs. They just don't. And he's a phenomenal pass blocker. Pass blocker. I love Cody Schrader sticking in to try and protect Mahomes. I love that about him. And then the one where I went with Cooper DeJean and Malachi Corley without a tackle, I went with Frank Crum, developmental tackle, who's 6'8". He was the third most athletic tackle in a lot of the grading metrics. Mm-hmm. I think if you're going developmental tackle, if I love Wanye, if you want to have a little fun behind him, Frank Crum would be the guy I'd go with.
Yeah. Dylan, Anybody there in the seventh round, or are you just throwing darts?
Yeah, I honestly think they believe that they may not have two of the three current interior offensive linemen after 2 years from now.
Yeah, for
so
sure.
That might be why they went double up on these interior guys. So I'll just stick with
it. Yeah,
them.
No, I understand the thought process, and I think you're coming into the last year of Creed Humphrey and Trey Smith. Like, you've got to make some decisions, and you can't just
and
simply
Tooney.
Say,
Tooney's
yeah,
getting up there.
For sure. That, hey, you got Caliendo, and then what? Well, we'll find some guys, and you don't want to go into next year saying we're in a position of need where we got to take some interior offensive linemen or something, and maybe have to take a tackle as well. Like, who knows what this team looks like next year? So I totally understand the thought process there. I would have been really happy if Blake Watson had signed as a priority free agent, since he was not drafted, and therefore you could have ended up with C.J. Hansen and also then Blake Watson. But hopefully, again, Imani Bailey is a guy that, you know, can fill that role if he makes the squad. You know, he's an undrafted free agent, but he got a decent little bit of coin to sign with the Chiefs. So he was a clear priority free agent because they didn't just send him like $5,000. Like, he got some guaranteed dollars to go along with. I think he got like $200,000 or something pretty decent as an undrafted free agent. That I was like, no, this guy, if they had another seventh rounder, I think he would have been the pick, because that's the money they spent to make sure he was a guy that signed with them. And I believe he was also one of their top 30 visits. I could be wrong about that. I'm not sure.
Those guys, though, always make me a little, always a lot of hype.
Yeah,
I know. I always get, Denarik Prince,
I know,
had that hype.
Yep, absolutely. We'll see what Carson Steele is. People like the Carson Steele pickup.
Could be a steal.
All right, wrapping up this hour, we'll talk to Mick Schaefer coming up in the 1 o'clock hour. Learn, funniest, best, we got that coming your way. Get Mick's thoughts on the NFL draft with the Kansas City Chiefs, what they ended up doing, their 7 picks. I love the draft. I love the picks. We're talking about sort of splitting hairs and just going through if there was somebody that they drafted that you would have liked to see them draft, or somebody other than who they drafted. And we're sort of going back to that Mecole Hardman, DK Metcalf thing. And there are a couple of there, but if you know what, if Kalen Carson and Kamal Hayden end up being sort of the same player, when they got him a round later. And if Norzad ends up being a really valuable piece that can come in and fill a void or fill a role, or maybe he plays right guard next year if they let Trey Smith walk, okay, you got some value there. And if they get some speed at the running back position, well, then, you know, they made me happy, which is what Brett Veach should be worried about.